Welcome on to our continuing series, Season Previews on the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. This is the Detroit Pistons, and before that, y'all should definitely go and check out some of the previous ones that we've done. The Bulls one with Doug Tonis was great. I just had Candace Buckner on talking about the Paul George at the four situation. Chris Haynes was also really good talking about the Tristan Thompson situation, and obviously both of them previewed the teams as well, and Paul Coro talking about Markieff Morris. So those are three really interesting situations that we were able to get the beat writers on. We're lucky to have them. But now, founder of Piston Powered, previous writer for Piston Powered, no longer a writer for Piston Powered, unless he has changed that since our last podcast, but still our resident Pistons expert, Dan Feldman.
Hey, you got all of those titles absolutely correct this time.
Well, we're all about precision here on the podcast.
Oh, don't I know it.
What's going on, man?
Oh, not too much. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. So we were just talking before I started recording. You're back in Detroit now, going to be covering the team up close again. Are you excited as a Michigan native and I presume still sort of Pistons fan?
Oh, yeah. It's great to be back here. It's an exciting time for the Pistons. I think they're on the rise. I think they have to be after the last 6 years. But yeah, it's an exciting time to see a team hopefully coming together.
And you've got a full 3, 4, or 5 days left before the first lake effect snow as well.
What do you mean 3 or 4 or 5 days left? I think it happened a couple weeks ago.
Well, I figured with global warming, it would be a little bit better than it was in my youth. I grew up in Chicago. My dad's family is in Michigan, so we would always drive there. And in the midst of a snowstorm half the time, it seemed like. But anyway, before we recreate the boring weather conversations that I used to have in the elevator at my old job, let's talk some Pistons. The first question I always like to ask people on these is, how good was the team last year, because that's kind of the starting point for projecting them this year. You kind of do what they did last year, take a look at what the additions and subtractions were, and kind of try to puzzle out where they might be this year. But that's kind of a harder question with all the transactions that they had. They basically almost had like three separate seasons last year.
Right. I was actually going to pin it into four. Three of those were pretty distinct, though. The first being when they had Josh Smith and were starting Smith, Greg Monroe, and Andre Drummond together. And
I can't believe that didn't work out, by the way.
Yeah, who would have thought after a full year of seeing it not work that the next 20 games would also not work? And it was as disastrous as it could get.
But, I mean, then again, though, this is a team that basically has not really had, like, a starting quality three on the roster for a while. And you can at least make the argument that those are their three most talented front court guys. But, yeah, I mean, there's just no way it could work out. I mean, even just, like, a shooting machine who, like, couldn't move and would fire up three-pointers probably would have been a better start at the three than, like, Josh Smith at that point.
Well, you could have made that point 2 years ago, and a lot of people, including myself, did, that maybe just having the talent out there would work. But after a full season of it not working, to go back to it the next year, and this is what happens when you change coaches, you change general managers, I don't think Stan Van Gundy realized, no, this cannot work. But if you were here all of the previous season, I think he's smart enough to realize it wouldn't have.
All right, so they obviously were terrible. What were they, 5-23 when they moved on from Smith and just waived him?
Yeah, give or take, that was about where it was. And then as soon as they got rid of him, they took off. Brandon Jennings started playing the best basketball of his life. Everything clicked. They were playing faster. They were defending better. One thing I don't think enough people realized, when Smith was in Detroit, he is a good defensive player. He's not a good defensive three. Guys chased him around the perimeter, off screens, and he had trouble keeping up, trouble keeping focus. Some of them were too fast for him. Some of it was a combination. They got better in all phases of the game without Smith and took off. And were just one of the best teams in the league for a decent stretch.
They're an interesting argument for that stretch on just fit within a system, fit of the parts together, how that can trump talent sometimes, right? Because you just finally had them playing the way they wanted to play a lot of the game. You know, they'd start Monroe and Drummond together, but then a lot of the game they were playing with one or the other at center, and then, an Anthony Tolliver type. I mean, they got him, I think, kind of, if I remember correctly, for nothing, basically, from the Suns around that same time, started playing him a lot. at the four to just get even a slight modicum of spacing, and all of a sudden it was working for them because they're just playing the way that Stan Van Gundy likes to play.
Right, and I know when we talked about what we're going to talk about, you asked me if there are any interesting stats, so I'm going to push one right here. Last season, when Monroe and Drummond played together, the Pistons were outscored by 1.7 points per 100 possessions. When Tolliver and Drummond played together, they outscored opponents by 5 points per 100 possessions.
Wow.
And Tolliver is not a great player. I mean, he fits a role, though. He was that stretch four, and Monroe is definitely a better player in isolation. But the combination, it just wasn't quite as good. And so when you have, like, just a capable stretch four with Drummond, they were a really good team.
One thing that I didn't realize about this team that I just looked at stats-wise, they actually had an expected one loss based on their point differential of 38 and 44, a team that had been utterly anemic offensively for quite some time, actually was 15th in offensive rating. So that's actually a surprise for a team that finished 32 and 50. They're actually extremely unlucky last year. And so do you think that now they've lost Monroe? That's not great. You know, that's a lot of talent that they've lost. Jennings was great for the time when they had a bunch of their wins. You can't imagine he's not going to be back for a while. He's not going to be the same guy. They have Reggie Jackson now. I mean, what do you think? Do you think this team can be better than last year?
I do. And I think part of it is what you said, that maybe they weren't quite as bad as their record looks. Part of it is the guys they brought in, they all fit. And I believe in Stan Van Gundy as a coach. I think he's proven that over a long enough stretch of time that he's a good coach. And he's also in charge of the front office now. He got a roster he wants. You bring in Ersin Ilyasova, you know, he can play power forward. He's a legitimate bona fide starter in the NBA, and he's a stretch four like Tolliver. You bring in Marcus Morris and Stanley Johnson, small forward. I mean, after the trade deadline, the Pistons gave up Kyle Singler in that trade to get Reggie Jackson. They basically punted the small forward position. They were putting out Caron Butler and Tayshaun Prince, guys way over the hill. They just sort of acknowledged, hey, if we can get Reggie Jackson in the fold, it's worth not having a small forward for half of what's appearing to be a lost season. So there's going to be a big upgrade there. And you bring in Aaron Baines, who's the capable backup center. Monroe was kind of filling that role at times last year. Joel Anthony was too. I think Baines is a big upgrade over Joel Anthony. So I think they have more talent in the places Van Gundy wants talent. Now, Monroe's a big loss, but I do think the fit difference can matter in terms of a so-so bad team becoming a so-so good team.
Once they got Jackson, how well were they playing? What was their style of play, and what do you think that augurs for this year?
Well, what was interesting was Jackson was awesome. I mean, 20 points, 10 assists. It wouldn't be rare to see him put up both in a game. I mean, he looked great. The team was not playing well. That was probably their worst stretch. Well, I don't know. Maybe it wasn't their worst stretch. The beginning was so bad. It was a bad stretch. They didn't look good as a team. And they were still trying to figure out how to play. Jackson was trying to learn how to play on the fly. They'd try to run. I don't think they ran as much as Van Gundy wanted. Everything was really based on the Jackson-Drummond pick and roll. I think that's going to be the starting point again next year, and everything's going to work off that. You can start to see it coming together in some ways. But on a team level, it just never clicked with Jackson the way it had with Jennings when things were going well, at least.
Yeah, and Jennings, I don't know. From watching the games, I thought that the way he was playing during that stretch seemed kind of unsustainable. He was hitting a lot of tough, contested jumpers. I felt like, although he did have that one crazy game where he had like 23 assists or something too, so he did have some better playmaking. But let's get into this year now. How do you see the new additions to this team fitting in? I think that starts with Stanley Johnson.
Well, I think it starts with Ilyasova, because when you have Drummond...
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I guess I was thinking in more of a temporal standpoint, but even that, actually, yeah, the trade was before the draft. So, you're right. Ilyasova, I think... how do you see him fitting in? Let's start there.
Oh, okay. So with Ilyasova, he's the same style as Anthony Tolliver. He's a stretch four who's going to try on defense, and we've seen that work. But Ilyasova, like I said, he's a bona fide starting power forward in the NBA. he's had some ups and downs, but I really think on the whole, if he's a starter, you're not going to panic. If Anthony Tolliver's your starting power forward, that's going to raise a lot of eyebrows. So you get this talent upgrade, and you get a fit that you know works.
Yeah, I liked what I saw from Ilya Sova at Eurobasket, obviously a lower level of competition, but I think really 2 years ago when the Bucks had that terrible season, he really kind of struggled with lower body injuries, didn't look right as he was shooting the ball. Last year, he was a little bit better. He took 34% of his shots from three-point range, and he actually shot 39% on threes last year after shooting only 28% the year before. And his jumper looked quick, both from the mid-range and from three at Eurobasket. He's always been a decent rebounder. I would worry a little bit about his defense compared to Tolliver. I'm not sure if he's quite as good defensively.
Well, I think one big problem Tolliver has is he's not this great athlete, and I think defensively he would wear down throughout games. The best thing he can do is give effort, and he tried to. I think in a starting role, or when you asked him to fill a major role close to that, it was a little much for him defensively over time. Ilya Sova, I think, obviously not a great athlete himself, but better, a little bit bigger, and can hold his own over a longer stretch.
Yeah, I guess I was sort of thinking more of Tolliver's mobility, but yeah, I think on the interior, Tolliver is always kind of a 3-4 tweener. Ilya Sova, I think, is a pure 4. Before we go on, I want to tell you all about DraftKings.com. Way better than FanDuel, by the way. I can't believe I didn't think of this before when I did these ads, but all my friends who do daily fantasy do DraftKings instead of FanDuel because FanDuel has kickers, which are impossible to project. It's just total luck. Anyone who can tell you that they think that they can figure out what a kicker is going to do is definitely not true. It's just an annoying aspect of fantasy football. If you have it in your regular league, you should probably get rid of kickers too. My good league does not have kickers. My bad league does. But anyway, DraftKings.com is America's favorite fantasy daily fantasy site. And you can win up to $1 million in their weekly daily fantasy contests. And you can also use my Capspace code, that's all one word, to get free entry in this week's $1 million fantasy challenge. That's DraftKings.com, Capspace code, all one word. All right, so Ilya Sova, I think, is going to help having a real stretch for Stanley Johnson and Marcus Morris. It seems like they are going to be competing to start at the three, or is it kind of Morris's job to lose and Johnson just isn't ready yet?
I think it's somewhere in between there. I think it's Morris's job to lose. I think they traded for him with the expectation that Morris was going to be the starting small forward on day one. But I think the intent, whether or not it was the intent, I think what they set up was, this is a bar Johnson can clear in not too long. At some point, I think Johnson is going to be better than Morris. It might be before opening night. It might be midway through the season. It might be by his second season. I don't think it's going to take too long for Morris to get passed by Johnson. But for right now, I think if I had to pick the opening night starter, I'm going to pencil in Morris.
Yeah, Van Gundy praised Morris's post-up ability, which is not out of the question when you have Ilya Sova, that Morris could maybe take advantage of small forwards in the post. Decent standstill shooter. Doesn't do a ton other than those two things, though, and certainly I would think of as a below-average defender at small forward. Really, long-time listeners know my philosophy is if you're kind of a tweener, it's usually better to play up, and that's generally not what Morris has done in his career, a lot of that being because there are superior options at power forward. I think actually off the bench, he might make a nice small ball option, maybe in competition with Tolliver, because I think he's a better shooter than Tolliver is, or at least a more versatile shooter. But when I wrote my piece about kind of questions to answer for teams, one of them for the Pistons was, is Stanley Johnson going to be ready? And I think the Pistons would love it if he could actually win the job because he is the future at that position.
Absolutely. Van Gundy's really done nothing but rave about Johnson, and sometimes it's tough to tell. Is he saying Stanley Johnson is great for a player, or he's great for a rookie who hasn't played a game yet? And you know, I think part of the reason it's so tough to tell is Van Gundy took a chance drafting Stanley Johnson. I think he recognized that most people had Justice Winslow rated higher, And when Winslow's there and you're passing on him for a guy at the same position, it's going to raise some eyebrows. So Van Gundy has a lot of reputation, I guess you'd say, invested in this pick. I don't think his job is going to be on the line. He's, you know, he's very secure there. But his reputation is a little bit on the line with how Johnson develops.
What did you think of that pick? You think it should have been Winslow, or were you cool with Johnson?
Yeah, I would have taken Winslow. I think they're somewhat similar. Maybe Johnson is a little bit more skilled offensively right now, but I think the way Winslow plays, he's a little bit better defensively. I'm worried that Johnson didn't shoot as well in the paint last season as you would have thought, given how athletic he at least seems. That raised a small red flag for me. If you asked me before the draft, would I be happy to get Stanley Johnson at number 8, I would have said yes. But that'd be without knowing Winslow was still on the board.
Yeah, the way I see it between the two, I think Winslow has a little bit of a higher upside, more of a kind of shifty dribble drive game, a little bit more athletic, especially off 2 feet. Stanley's got some pretty good rise off of 1 foot, but he can't really jump off of 2 feet at all for his size. But I think that Stanley is more likely to grow into an effective NBA starter and be a solid 3-and-D guy on the wing. He's a much better shooter, much quicker release than Winslow. Even though Winslow shot a better percentage from college three, Stanley, I think, is much more repeatable there. And I think that Stanley's defense, just being a little bit bigger and stronger, ultimately might make him a more versatile defender than Winslow. So I completely understand the pick, especially because Winslow might be a little bit more of a two type if he can get his jump shot going. And Winslow also has that variable that maybe he'll never really learn to shoot it that well, whereas Stanley, I think, is getting close to there already. And when he showed it in the 26 points that he had in the preseason, I think it was last night, you know, his jumper looked pretty good, as it did in summer league.
Well, I agree pretty much with everything you said, with the slight exception of Winslow's defense, and compared to Johnson's, I'm a little higher on Winslow defensively. But my concern is the Pistons made this pick because Johnson's a little bit further along in his development, rather than which player is more valuable overall. Because obviously you do have to take into account what's their potential ceiling and how good they are right now. I'm concerned, given that you have a president who's also a coach who wants to win right now, maybe they put too much emphasis on who is slightly ahead at this moment.
Yeah, although also Stanley is extremely young. I think he just turned 19 in July. So that's another feather in his cap as far as his ultimate potential. I really like what this team has going on long-term on the wings. When I did a piece last year about trying to make an all-star team for the East, and I was trying to fill out the end of the roster with guys who might be kind of 3-and-D guys who would work. This is like a real team of all-stars who would fit together, not necessarily the 12 best players. There weren't any 3-and-D guys in the East. You know, it was basically Chris Middleton, and it was Damari Carroll, and that was it. And the Pistons actually, in Caldwell Pope and Stanley Johnson, now maybe have two guys who could fit that bill eventually.
Shumpert, I guess, maybe is in there?
Yeah, I guess so. At the time that I wrote that piece, that's true. He had just gotten traded, but he won't be fulfilling any role for the next 3 months. But yeah, I mean, I think, and also I don't think Shumpert is quite, he can't really defend threes the way those two guys can. You know, I'm talking about a guy who can shift between either position. But yeah, that's a good point. But Caldwell Pope, a guy who, until I started prepping for this season, I didn't realize that he was like in the top 15 in three-pointers attempted, shot a little bit below the league average, but just for a guy in his second year to be getting up that many shots, he led the team in minutes played, actually, another thing that I didn't realize about him. How do you feel about his potential going into this year, and what does he need to work on other than just upping his three-point percentage to really get into being a solid starter?
There is a lot to like about him. I think he's going to be somebody who can fill a limited role and maybe fill it very, very well, which I think is important. I think there are a lot of players who try and diversify their game too much at the expense of being efficient at a certain number of things and deferring to their teammates where they're not efficient. He's a willing three-point shooter, but I guess the big problem he's had, and I think maybe you can put it all under the umbrella of confidence, his shot selection, it comes and goes. Sometimes, especially early in his career, and he's gotten a lot better at this, he'd defer way too much. He'd be maybe even afraid to shoot. And then sometimes his confidence would get up and he'd gun way too much. So he needs to find that middle ground of taking his shots within the flow all the time. And you can see that confidence issue in his home road splits. He was great at home. On the road, he was pretty shaky, and it was pretty startling how drastic the difference was. And you look at a guy, I mean, you watch him play, his shot looks good, it looks smooth, he looks like he should be well above league average. And we see he's not I think some of that is confidence. He's excelled in summer league, he's excelled, you know, in some of these late season games that don't matter. And at times he's excelled when the going is tough. But he's been a little too streaky. So I think as he gets older, he was a real young player when they drafted him. He hasn't done anything that's really changed my opinion of his path. I think he was a good pick. I think he's going to turn out to be pretty good. He just needs to continue developing, continue playing, and getting that confidence.
How about the D part of the 3-and-D equation for him?
He's a good defender. I think Pistons fans tend to overrate him because for a long time, the Pistons have been pretty terrible at defending on the perimeter. And so he comes in, and even as a rookie, he's, you know, maybe a above average defender. And if you watch everybody in the league, you're not going to rave about him. But compared to what Pistons fans are used to seeing, he's looked fantastic. So I do think he needs to get a little better there. He could get a little stronger. That could help. But he's a good defender. He moves his feet well. He's quick. So, yeah, I think he's a good defender, and I think he has room to get better as he gets stronger.
All right, well, let's go into the next aspect here. I mean, pretty much I think everyone on this team who's a key piece is probably going to get better. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a young team, right?
Right. You know, a lot of their older players they've gotten rid of, but you start with Drummond. You know, I think he's going to get better. Caldwell Pope, I think, is going to get better. Spencer Dinwiddie made a lot of progress, and depending on how long Jennings is out, depending on how washed up Steve Blake is, Spencer Dinwiddie might be the backup point guard. So he could get real minutes in ways he didn't last year, at least early. He should be better. It's a pretty young team. Those are the three guys I'd say are most in line to get better. But really, across the board, you should see improvement everywhere.
Andre Drummond had kind of a weird year last year. I mean, if you had to guess what his field goal percentage was last year, what would you say it was? Or maybe you looked at it recently.
I haven't looked at it recently. 51.
That's exactly right. Yeah, 51.4, which is terrible for him, I think, right? Like, but part of the reason for that was they actually kind of tried to expand his game in the beginning of the year. Had him doing all these post-ups, which he, frankly, is pretty bad at. And then, of course, his free-throw percentage is pretty miserable, too. So you actually have, for a guy like him, who should be shooting maybe half of his shots as dunks, had a true shooting percentage of about 500, well below the league average, which is usually about 53% or so. You know, you talk about growth, and a lot of times that is, oh, you're adding a skill. In his case, maybe it's post-ups, right? But on the other hand, you could argue that maybe he will have a better season by just refining the things that he's already good at. Where do you kind of come down on that question for him?
Well, last year, I really liked how they used him. I thought it was great to work on his post-ups because the Pistons weren't going anywhere anyway. And this season, it's going to be feeling it out to some degree. If they look like they can contend for a playoff spot, and that's really that's all the goal is here, make the playoffs. And if it looks like they can contend for a playoff spot, yeah, then maybe you shy away from giving him post-ups all the time and force-feeding him, and you just have him crash the glass, and you involve him in pick-and-rolls, and that's about it. In long-term, that might be the best thing for him, but there's no way to know until you really get him working in the post in years where he can do it, in years where you're headed to the lottery anyway. So I do think they'll sort of shift back, and they did later last season. They started to shift back more toward using him in the pick and roll and letting him crash the glass and not really thinking about post-ups. So if I were running the team, it would be a little cautious at first with the post-ups until we see how he does with them and we see where the team is going.
I really like him, especially big, huge bodies like him, and if they're going to run more this year especially, getting that deep seal post-up right away in transition, especially going for that at times when they are not in the bonus yet, get the other team into the bonus, force them to foul him, which they're obviously going to do a lot with him shooting 39% from the line. Those are the plays that I really like for him. I don't think he has the skill level, the counter moves yet. He's got like an okay kind of floater touch when he's on the move, but when he has a body on him, he isn't able to knock guys back quite the way you'd expect for someone of his size. But I think the pick and roll with Reggie Jackson would be great. I mean, I think also another way to get him the ball is kind of have him run a pick and roll, throw it to the wing, and then have him try and get a steal, and so he can go right up with a layup instead of having to fake someone out. And I think with his speed and his girth, he should be good at that. But I agree with you. I mean, this is a team that actually could do something this year. And if he's not effective on those post-ups, I think they kind of have to go away from it.
One problem with your plan to get the ball to a wing and then to him is the Pistons' wings, really, I don't know if they're the worst in the NBA as far as handling the ball and distributing for others, but they got to be down there. I mean, KCP, that's not his game. That's not Marcus Morris's game. Maybe Stanley Johnson can do it, especially in time, but at least with their starting wings, these are not ball handlers. A lot of the pressure is going to be on Reggie Jackson to deliver the ball to everybody, and that could hurt Drummond's post-up specifically if they know where the entry pass is coming from.
Yeah, Jody Meeks, never well known as a passer either, only 1.9 assists per, or I'm sorry, yeah, 1.9 assists per 36 minutes for him, so as a 6'4 guy, you'd like a little more from that, although he's kind of a shooter. Meeks is somewhat of an underrated player, though. This is going to be my next question, is kind of who is either over or underrated on this team from a national perspective that you might get a little more insight to watching them. Their whole season turned around when he came back, and they had someone who could drain some shots on the perimeter.
We might disagree.
In addition to dumping Smith. I mean, I'm not giving him all the credit, obviously.
I really think somebody who's underrated nationally is Reggie Jackson. There was a lot of scorn for his five-year, $80 million contract.
Yeah, where'd you come down on that?
I would have liked to try to get him for less, and maybe they did, but I don't think so. I think from the moment they got him, they anointed him the point guard of the future, said he was a franchise-type player, a real core piece, and that they were going to treat him as such. And maybe they're right. Maybe that's what he needed after being in Oklahoma City and really being pushed aside there, obviously somewhat fairly when the team has Russell Westbrook. But maybe this gives him the confidence to be even better. I would like them to try for less, and I think they could have gotten him for less if they really played hardball. But that's not what they wanted to do, and I thought it was an okay deal.
Yeah, on our mock-off season, I think we ended up with him making like $13 million a year. He ended up signing 5 for 80, so basically $16 million a year. And that $3 million, while cap dorks like us will kind of bemoan it, and if you do it a lot of times, that can kind of add up. With the way the cap is rising in this, and also just kind of Detroit not exactly being a free agent haven, that $3 million is not really the end of the world, even though it was kind of a contract that at least Danny and I made fun of a little bit.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world, but it could go toward another good player at some point over the next 5 years.
Yeah, and we talk about how in the new environment, starting this summer, an average starter might be worth $15 million on the free market. Reggie Jackson has not proven to be an average starter at point guard. I mean, that's actually a higher bar than people realize they have to clear. I mean, you're talking about some pretty good guys as the 15th best point guard in the league. That's like Ty Lawson or something like that, if you really go down the list. And he hasn't been as good as Ty Lawson has been yet. But with his physical tools, it's possible that he could be that way. He shot better on threes in his time in Detroit. Small sample size, but he's up to 33%, which is a big difference from being in the 20s. At least you have to respect him. Do you think he can come close to that number again this year?
I think he can top it. I really liked his stroke coming out of Boston College. I thought he would shoot better in the pros at threes. I'm a little surprised he hasn't. But I think Stan Van Gundy has a strong track record of developing shooters. And he handpicked Jackson as his guy, and he knows how important shooting is. They hired Dave Hopla as shooting coach over the offseason. You might have seen him. He's that old-looking guy who just drills three-pointer after three-pointer in those YouTube videos, you know, just an insane number in a row.
I remember him from such films as those YouTube videos.
Yeah, so I think Reggie Jackson, I don't know, I always thought he should shoot better than he does. And I think now he's going to have the people around him to help him get there. I'm not saying he's going to be great, but I think he could be, you know, maybe very slightly below league average.
What do you see as the playing time battles on this team? We talked about the three, obviously, already. Are there any other ones where you're going to be watching positions, even as you know, the first backup off the bench at a certain position, that could be critical for this team?
Well, I think the big one is, just to start, who makes the team? The Pistons have 17 guaranteed salaries. Danny Granger, I think, is close to a lock to be cut. I think the other spot's going to come down to either Cartier-Martin or... I'm blanking on who else they have now.
John... Oh, no, wait. No, that's yesterday. That's last year's roster.
Reggie Bullock.
Reggie Bullock, right. Yeah. I mean, Adonis Thomas, I assume you're not counting him. Right. Darren Hilliard? What about Darren Hilliard?
Well, they just drafted Darren Hilliard. You know, I don't think they're going to admit that was a mistake. And he's obviously younger than the other guys. So I think he's pretty safe, but he should be in the mix, at least if you have a true open competition.
Okay. So who do you like then to make the team out of those guys?
I think Cartier-Martin's going to be the one who's cut. You know, he kind of had a down year last year. He was hurt, and at one point Van Gundy insinuated that Martin wasn't doing enough to get healthy and get back on the court, and he really didn't have a chance to make a positive impression otherwise. So and he's older than Bullock. So I guess Martin's best chance is that Van Gundy knows Martin better, and maybe Bullock is just a stranger who doesn't have a chance to prove himself. But I think the lasting impression from last year with Martin is a little bit negative, and I think that's going to keep him out.
They have to make a decision on Reggie Bullock's, is it his fourth year? It's his fourth year option, right?
Yeah.
You think they'll take that, and would you?
That's a good question. If he's going to make the team, obviously, I think I would, because it's about, what, $2.3 million? It's such a low price that I'd rather eat $2.3 million down the line if I have to, where you have the upside of maybe even having a rotation player under contract for $2.3 million and then have him as a restricted free agent for the next year. I think the upside is too high, even if you don't think he'll be worth it. Would you exercise it?
Yeah, I think I would for the exact reason you said. I mean, he's going into his third year and still has the tools to be a 3-and-D guy. Hasn't really shown much yet, but hasn't gotten a ton of time in his previous stops in L.A. and Phoenix. Granted, maybe there was no reason to give him that time based on his practice performance, but you might as well keep him around. I think he's got more potential than a lot of guys that you might bring in. And if you're really, really desperate to sign somebody and you need some of that money next summer, you could always just stretch him and get almost all of it over what would be, I guess, you know, you'd basically be down to like $600,000. So you're getting almost as much room as if you just hadn't signed him at all compared to like a cap hold or a roster charge. So, yeah, I think you might as well just bring him back. And as we said, this is not a team that's really been raking in the free agents. So I think having him for $2.1 million is probably better than they might do in the market next year, or at least the chance of him being good.
Right.
So you talked about that one. Any other playing time battles? I guess point guard, we assume once Jennings is healthy, that'll probably be his. But for the time being, it's going to be Dinwiddie and who's the other guy you said?
Steve Blake.
And Steve Blake. Yeah, I guess it would be nice to see Dinwiddie win that because Blake, I think, you know, has kind of shown that he's done over the last couple of years. But if he can't, that might be a sign that Dinwiddie, not a great sign for his career, I guess. We'll put it that way.
Agreed there.
All right, so nothing else as far as, I guess, like the backup four position too, maybe might be something to watch.
I think Anthony Tolliver has a pretty good grip on that. I think what could be interesting, like we were talking about earlier, if Stanley Johnson is really ready to go, who's the starting power forward? I think Ilyasova would have the edge, But I don't think it's inconceivable that Marcus Morris could go down to the starting power forward and push Ilyasova to the bench.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about having Drummond, who's such a monster rebounder, is that you don't have to worry as much about rebounding at the power forward position. So they can even go slow and go smaller. One of the things I like a lot about Stanley Johnson's potential, maybe over Winslow, is that he is big enough and strong enough that he can absolutely play as a small ball four quite a bit in the future, maybe even as soon as this year. And maybe you could run with Pope at the three, Meeks at the two, and Stanley Johnson at the four. That could be a really nice shooting team, versatile team that can switch a lot. So that might be a look they could try as well.
That's a lineup I'm looking forward to seeing.
Okay, next question here. What are the big strengths of this team? Oh, actually, no. First of all, I want to ask you what your crunch time lineup is for this team.
It's probably pretty similar to the starting lineup. Reggie Jackson, Caldwell Pope, Ilyasova, Drummond, and whichever of Johnson and Morris win the job. If you want to get a little more offensive punch, depending on the situation, you could put in Meeks at the wing and maybe shift down Morris or Johnson. But I think it's going to look pretty similar to the starting lineup.
You think we might see Caldwell Pope at the three sometimes?
Oh, definitely. I think
even when they don't go small, even when you've got just Ilyasova in as well. That if they don't have a LeBron James, Jimmy Butler, smash you in the mouth type of small forward, I think they could get away with that.
Yeah, they'll definitely do it at times. The biggest impediment to that is I think Anthony Tolliver is somebody you want to get minutes more than Jody Meeks. So if you're pushing everybody down, that probably squeezes out Tolliver. I think Meeks is going to have to play better than he did last year to get minutes over Tolliver.
But he saved their season last year. How could you say that? Maybe actually one of the largest overstatements I've ever had on the podcast. Correlation is not causation, folks. What are the big strengths of this team?
It all starts with Andre Drummond. I mean, he's a franchise player, both because he's so good right now and so young. But he's in this moment, he's so far better than everybody else they have. So that obviously goes to his biggest strength, which is rebounding, particularly offensively. Ilyasova can be a pretty good offensive rebounder. So can Marcus Morris for his position. So, I really just think rebounding is the area they're going to control.
Yeah, I like that for them, too. I wouldn't say this is necessarily a huge strength, but compared to years past, it is. It's nice that they don't have anybody really who's terrible anymore.
Yes.
And that was always an underrated problem for these teams. They had two good guys in Drummond and Monroe up front, but then Smith was terrible at the three. At the two, a lot of times when KCP was younger, or they didn't really have any shooting. So now I think really backup point guard as they start the year is the only spot that I really worry about in the rotation as just sort of like a gaping hole. And that's a departure from past years.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then once Jennings comes back, that can sort of be a strength. I think Brandon Jennings is, and this might be slightly too strong, but he might be overqualified as a backup point guard. He's probably deserving to be a low-end starter.
Yeah, certainly if he plays the way that he played during the Foreman F and Wall days.
Sure. I'm not counting on him playing that way ever again. But, yeah, if he does, then he's definitely overqualified.
What's the latest on his health, by the way?
Oh, there's conflicting stuff. He should be getting – he's doing a little bit of movement now. He should be dialing it up. But, I think he'll be back before the end of the year, maybe sometime in November.
When did he tear it, early February or something?
I want to say January.
Yeah, so that's actually a pretty decent amount of time. I don't know whether that means that his recovery is not going amazingly well. This is also a contract year for him, so that's another reason to kind of take it conservatively. They're not counting on him to start, but when you look at kind of where Wes Matthews is, Kobe, when he came back, obviously that was not a successful comeback for him right away with his Achilles, but he does seem to be going a little bit more slowly than some of the other guys we've seen.
Well, I think part of that was, yes, slower than other guys, but when he first got hurt, he tweeted 6 to 9 months, which just from the outset seemed unrealistic. So it seems
that, well, that's the actual timetable that they always give.
Is it?
Is 6 to 9 months. Yeah.
That seems quick. It seems like
that's what they said when Kobe got hurt.
Most guys, it seems like, take a little longer than that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's obviously one of the most crippling injuries, and I'm not trying to be critical of him at all. It's just I feel like it's a little bit behind the timetable if we're trying to project out how he might be this year, that maybe it's not going as well as it does for some guys. So we talked about the strengths. What is going to be a weakness for this team, the key weakness?
Well, if we're starting everything with Andre Drummond, the big one, I think, is free throw percentage.
This just in. Yeah.
I mean, you know, even Ilyasova was down a little bit last year. By and large, this is not a great free throw shooting team. And if the Pistons get good enough where teams care to strategize against them, teams are going to hack Drummond. You know, it's not going to be pretty.
Would you leave him on the court if they do that to him, or take him off if you're Stan?
Oh, there are so many variables depending on the game situation. You know, you can take him off at times. You can leave him in on times. I think it depends on a lot of different things in each situation. Do you have an overall philosophy on that for this team?
And he's really bad. I mean, my philosophy, especially if you're doing it during like the third quarter or something, is I would just leave the guy in, and you can just basically play your starters for longer because they're getting a huge rest every time. You can set your defense. You just stop every time and let those guys get into foul trouble. We saw in the playoffs there are a bunch of times where you can't just keep fouling indefinitely. Eventually, you're going to accidentally get too many fouls on somebody. Like Manu Ginobili fouled out because of the intentional fouling on DeAndre Jordan one time, right? Tim Duncan even got into foul trouble by taking an intentional foul early and then getting a bunch more later on. So to me, especially because also you almost could embarrass people out of it if you just keep letting them do it. And you also hope that the guy is going to start making it. I think, you know, this idea of, all right, they started fouling him. He just went 1 for 4. That means we got to take him out. You know, that doesn't, there's nothing to that because it's just random. You know, the fact that he went 1 for 4 doesn't mean that he's now going to go 1 for 4 on his next four. He's still a 39% shooter. That's about what he's going to do. So, and I think when the other team is taking the ball out of the net or is coming back from a free throw, they're not going to score that much better. And ultimately the fouls are going to start to pile up. So I would just play a game of chicken with the other coach and just let him do it for, you know, 20 possessions in a row if that's what they want to do.
I generally agree with you. One thing I'd add, though, in this case, you say, all right, he makes 1 for 4. He doesn't turn into a 25% free throw shooter all of a sudden. Does Andre Drummond know that? Does he think that? You know, a lot of this is mental for him, and that's true of a lot of players who shoot like him. I'm not sure he views it the same way you and I do, that he's not all of a sudden a 25% free throw shooter, because I've seen him go in stretches where he gains confidence, where he makes 3 of 4, and you know the way he carries himself at the line. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe I'm seeing things that aren't there.
I think you are, to be honest. Like, I mean, I think it's really just more random. Now, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say that because even you know, in like my stupid rec league games, if I have to shoot a free throw and we're down by one, and I go to the line for 2 shots, like it does feel different. Now, maybe if I were, like, you know, a real athlete who actually practiced my free throws more than once every month, I would feel a lot more confident. But, you know, if I knew I were a 39% free throw shooter, maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. I think my view is he's so bad normally that it's like nothing's really going to make him any worse.
That's true. You just don't want to ruin him for the long term, that he'll never believe.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he could get the Andres Biedrins, although you know, I don't think he parties as much as Andres Biedrins either, and he hasn't gotten his rookie extension yet. All right, we're getting a bit far afield here. The other weakness that I see for this team is I think they can be pretty vulnerable to pick-and-roll switches. I don't like what they can necessarily do late clock. I don't think Drummond is that great of a post-up guy where you're scared to switch to pick and roll. Reggie Jackson, you know, we see that when there are switches, the best option a lot of times is just pulling up for a jumper. He's not that great at shooting off the dribble. Even if he's against a big man, I would be very happy to switch a big man onto him and let him shoot a jumper and try my luck there. And the guys on the wing, not really great one-on-one talents either. And the other thing you looked at is the passing as well. There's not really a lot of secondary playmaking on this team. When you reverse the ball to the weak side and you run a pick and roll, Maybe KCP can grow into that a little bit. Maybe Stanley Johnson can. Marcus Morris, not really a guy who does stuff off the dribble. So if it's not Reggie Jackson making the play, then who is it? That's the other thought that occurs to me on this team.
One way I think they'll try and combat the switching issues, I think you make an excellent point. You can run a pick and roll or a pick and pop with Ilyasova, and if they switch, you know, Ilyasova is going to crash the offensive glass.
Yeah, Stan talked about it in that Zach Lowe podcast.
Right. And, you know, like I said, the Pistons are already a good offensive rebounding team. I think they could, that could help them be even better.
All right, what are the key questions for this team? What's going to make or break their season in your view, where you say, all right, if this goes right, this team could be really good. If it goes wrong, they're out of the playoff mix completely.
I mean, essentially the grand question is, does fit matter more than the talent loss? Greg Monroe is better in a vacuum than anybody they got this offseason. But they got guys who Stan Van Gundy wanted. They have a starting caliber stretch four now. They have a legitimate small forward or two. This team fits better. And does that outweigh the talent loss?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, to me also, just how good are these young guys going to develop? They're really relying on young players, and yeah, those guys can really develop a lot and exceed expectations, but that is no guarantee that they're going to do that. And young guys obviously are usually worse defensively just from executing the scheme, experience, those sorts of things. So if they can start to get it, if Stan can coach these guys up, if the system, like you talked about, is really conducive to letting them improve, then yeah, I think this could absolutely be a playoff team. If not, they could be mired, you know, in the low 30 wins regardless. All right, give me your predicted record.
I'm going to go with 38-44 and just outside the playoffs.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I need to really sit down and think about these kind of lower rung East teams. Their playoff case improved a lot with this MKG news.
Sure.
I thought that Charlotte probably projected to maybe be a little bit better than them, and now I think they project to be worse. But again, it's just hard to know. It's hard to know with these guys. You didn't see that much of Reggie Jackson. A lot of it is just projecting, and so this is kind of one of the harder teams to project for me. I don't see them winning less than 30 unless there's a major injury, and we're not really taking that into account. That is one nice thing, though. They don't really have very many health questions other than Jennings at this point. Everyone else on this team is pretty durable.
Right.
And it's nice when you have young guys. That helps a little bit. What about the best-case scenario for this team? Everything goes right. What seed are they getting, if any, and what's their record?
Well, I'm glad.
And how does that occur?
I'm glad you said that. It was so hard to peg this team, because I'll feel a little bit better about how silly my best-case scenario is going to sound. But I think if everything goes right, you know, they could win 50 games. And I think we've seen in the past, where in a bad conference like this East is going to be, if you're a well-coached team and you play hard and things fit together, you can win about 50 games. You know, it wasn't that long ago that the Pistons did it with that exact formula when you were starting guys like Michael Curry and Clifford Robinson. I mean, it can be done. And, you know, that team would be in the upper echelon in this wide-open East behind Cleveland. To do it, number one, Andre Drummond's going to have to make that next step defensively, where he turns into the dominant defender he can be. And hasn't always
been. I should have put that in the key questions, by the way. That's huge. His physical tools certainly would indicate that he can get there, but you know, hasn't been there from a mental standpoint, and still, you know, this is his age 22 season. It's probably maybe not fair to expect him to get there yet, but they are going to be relying on him to do so.
Right. Really, in realistic terms, all you can hope for is he makes a nice gain in that department, but I don't think it's unreasonable to hope he gets it all this season. I think that's possible. Two, everybody's going to have to shoot well. That's Reggie Jackson getting around league average. That's Caldwell Pope getting well above there. That's Ilyasova not dipping down again like he has a couple times in the past. That's Morris getting around league average. You got to shoot well. And if you just bring the effort defensively around Drummond really figuring it out, Drummond could be the anchor. If everybody else can figure it out, or if he can figure out everybody else plays hard defensively and plays up to their capabilities, yeah, I think really just the best way things can go is you can get up right around 50 wins.
Yeah, maybe this team just goes crazy from three-point range around Drummond, and you know he starts to get into the high teens with his scoring average and becomes a shot-blocking monster. I mean, he's quick. I'm not sure there's really anyone in the whole league right now, maybe Dwight Howard, who has his combination of jumping ability, strength, and lateral movement. So he can definitely get there. He always tries to block shots with his left hand. It might be nice if he could use his right hand to block some shots too. That might be helpful. Just learn verticality a little better, get in position, not get in foul trouble. All that's really important. I don't see it quite at 50. I would go maybe 46, 47. And I also have to push back on one thing you said. I've said this on a couple of previews, is being in the East doesn't really affect your win total that much because 58 of the games that you're playing are the same. And there's been some research out there like 10 years ago that the most, even at max conference disparity, the biggest difference you're going to get is about a game and a half or two games. So I wouldn't say, because they're in the East, they're necessarily likely to win 50 games. Now you could say they might be more likely to advance in the playoffs because there's less competition. They might be more likely to get a higher seed. But just your raw win total, I don't think it affects it that much.
When we're done, you'll have to send me the article about it being 1.5 games. I'm interested to read that.
It's actually in Hollinger's Pro Basketball Prospectus book from like 2004. So I don't know, maybe we can find it on like Google Books or something. But it was a while ago. All right, worst case scenario, barring Drummond goes out for the year or some other cataclysmic injury, what's that worst case scenario? How does that happen?
Well, depends on your perspective. That worst case scenario might be that 38 wins I'm predicting, because then you're pretty good, probably not in the playoffs. You don't have a great draft pick, and you have to look at this team. I like some of these young players, but without maybe one more good draft pick, how much lower is the ceiling? If it's just worse in terms of record, it's probably right around 30 wins where they've been the last 6 years. And I don't think Pistons fans really need me to explain how you get there, because we've seen them get there every single year.
Yeah, I think just they're 19th in defense a year ago, and maybe they take a little bit of a step back on that even. I wouldn't expect a step back. I think their personnel is a little bit better this year, especially having gotten rid of Smith and more experience from Drummond. I don't think that losing Monroe as a backup center is going to hurt that much defensively, and losing him as a starting power forward won't hurt that much defensively either. So I think you can reliably expect that they will take a little bit of a step forward on defense, maybe even get up to about league average. I think that would be a reasonable goal for them. But if the young guys don't step forward from a shooting perspective, especially, and Reggie Jackson is kind of, doesn't take the anticipated leap as well, I could see them maybe not being that good. But I think their floor is actually pretty low with this team. I think it's, maybe even 32, 33 wins. So what is their over-under? You remember? I can't remember off the top of my head.
I've got it right here. I can tell you in a second. While I'm looking, the one thing I'd say about their defense from a pessimistic view,
who are you that you can talk and, look for that at the same time? I cannot do that. I do not possess that ability. I always listen to these podcasts where people are like, I'll just look it up while I'm talking. Like, how do you do that? I can't do that.
Well, I had it open before we started, so I just have to click over with my very loud mouse. So I was going to talk over my mouse clicks. On the pessimistic side with their defense, they are switching some things up. I don't think they're going to be hedging on the pick and roll as much. I think they're going to be a little more conservative, and I think those are good changes overall. But if you want to make the pessimistic case, it's, well, all the progress they made defensively last year, there's going to be another adjustment period this season. Their over-under is 33.5.
Yeah, I feel pretty decent about that over, especially now that I know that their point differential was so much higher. I don't think I realized that when we did our over-unders podcast because, I'm such a great researcher before I discuss these things. Anyway, yeah, the point is don't bet based on what I told you. These are for discussion purposes only. Yeah, I think that's really kind of their worst case. But, obviously there are always injuries, too, and we don't really factor that in as well as we probably should. All right, last question for you. This will be a good one for you, especially because we're both cap dorks. How would you rate the team's ownership and front office under this new regime, I guess, with Stan Van Gundy? And if you want to include the grade for the ownership, going back, Tom Gore is a little bit earlier, go ahead. But yeah, what would you say overall? What grade would you give the regime?
Well, just for Van Gundy, I think I'd go with about a C so far. He inherited Andre Drummond, and I think he's done an okay job. I didn't really like that they just waived Josh Smith rather than maybe sending him home, or I don't know, try one game bringing him off the bench and see if you can increase his trade value that way. That seemed a little drastic to me. I didn't like how they handled Greg Monroe. I think the writing was on the wall for a long time that he was going to leave, and you just ended up letting him walk, and not for nothing because you gained cap space. But if you manage that better, maybe you can get draft picks or something in exchange for him.
Yeah, well, they couldn't have traded him last year without his consent. That was obviously a big monkey wrench. So you're saying they should have done that?
I mean, why wouldn't he have consented? Was there any team that would have been worse for him to showcase himself before free agency that would have traded for him?
Yeah, I guess if he had zero reason to come back, because normally the reason you wouldn't want to get traded is because you lose your bird rights in that scenario when you're on a one-year contract. That's why he has the veto rights to begin with. But if he knew that he didn't want to come back, then maybe, but, you know, he wouldn't have had that high of a trade value. I mean, what do you think, if he would have consented for a trade, what do you think they could have gotten for him? Just, like, what is a fair value in a vacuum for Greg Monroe on a one-year deal, you know, at the trade deadline to a team, presumably a contender, and I'm not even sure who could have used him, but just in a vacuum, what would you give up for that if you're a GM? Would you give up like a lottery protected first rounder for that?
No, probably not. But part of the thing was the Pistons.
Oh, I mean, they got one. They got one for Aaron Aflalo, you know, in the last year of his deal.
But they would have had Aflalo's bird rights, full bird rights to bring him back if they wanted to.
Yeah, that's true. Although not a guy that you probably wanted to give a 5-year contract to. Anyway,
no, but a guy you might want to exceed the cap. So you're limited in your trade market. It either has to be a team that really, really wanted him as a rental and really thought he'd put him over the top, or a team that thought it could use him this season and would have had cap space to bring him back. And so you're looking at a small number. I just think the Pistons should have been more proactive looking for that team early in the season, maybe even before the season, because a big part of his value in a trade was during the season. So if you wait till the deadline, that's about half his value gone.
Yeah, that's true. Although maybe I think they felt like they could make the playoffs last year. I guess once they started 5-23, that was no longer the case.
Right.
And, you know, maybe if they had moved on from him, they could have played Josh Smith just starting at the four and gotten his value to be a little bit higher. But, you know, maybe he was just so toxic that they decided they had to get rid of him. And that's basically, for those who don't know, it's costing him, what, $5.4 million on the cap over the next 6 years? Is that right?
It's a little less by now, I hope.
Oh, why? Oh, just because he's signed a couple of other contracts? I mean, it's not going to be that much of an offset, I don't think. I mean, it's good, but it's probably around $5 million. How long does that go?
I think it's 5 more years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right, because, yeah, there was no stretch last year, and then he had 2 years left, so it stretched over 5 years, double the number of years in the contract plus one. So, yeah, but again, it's not. They still are going to have plenty of cap space, right, over these next two seasons, or I guess now five, but these next few years, they still project to have plenty of space. So I don't think, again, it's something that killed them, but from a sort of little moves, cap dorkery, these little things, paying Reggie Jackson a little bit too much, that kind of adds up.
Right. The one move I really love that they did was trading for Reggie Jackson. I think you get a guy who has the potential to be a pretty good starter.
They gave up nothing for him.
Yeah, 2 second-rounders, Kyle Singler, DJ Augustine, nothing.
Yeah, and that's a move that has some upside. Now, it's not quite as good now that you're paying him market value, and maybe some would say even above, but still, getting a starter for nothing is pretty impressive, I think.
But on the flip side of that, you look at the other move they made at the trade deadline. They essentially traded Jonas Jerebko for Tayshaun Prince, an older, more expensive player, and they were both on the final year of their contract. But just the philosophical idea of, hey, we need a placeholder small forward in what's probably a lost season, and let's give up a younger player who maybe you could have traded him somewhere else for
a second rounder and get one of those back that you sent for Jackson, or maybe you keep him. And honestly, I think Jerebko's, even though he's probably best at power forward, is a better small forward than Prince at this point in their careers. And so just some of those, you know, I don't want to make too big a deal of that, about that one move, but some of the philosophical things they've done to be marginally better right now when it doesn't matter, signing Aaron Baines. Yeah, he's probably the best backup center they could have gotten, but maybe you'd rather leave that money free for a time when it really matters.
Would you rather have him or Biombo?
Biombo. On their contracts?
Yeah.
Biombo. The problem is...
Yeah, I mean, they probably would have had to pay a little bit more to get Biombo.
Yeah, one, they probably would have had to pay more. Two, Baines is better, and he offers a different dimension if a team's following Drummond, or you want to... bring, you know, he's different than Drummond. I think Biombo's too similar, has too many of the same shortcomings, and that could leave you flawed in certain ways. But I'd rather have the younger, cheaper player with a little more upside.
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually, that I agree that Baines is actually better than Biombo, and probably by the end of that contract, I think Baines will be, what, 31, 32 by that point? So, and Biombo, I think, will be a theoretical 25. We don't know if his age for sure is the age that it is. But anyway, that again is probably a little bit too far afield. So C is your grade for them overall. I think
C is my grade for Van Gundy.
Okay. What about for Gores and his tenure? You're probably a little lower, huh?
It's actually going to be a little higher.
Okay.
I'd put him around B minus, and he's been trending steadily upward. He's given Van Gundy money to spend, to hire support staff, to hire a big front office, plenty of scouts. They bought a D-League team. They're investing in all the right ways. The big mistake Gores made, he made one overall one and one smaller one when he first came on. One was not realizing quick enough that he and Joe Dumars could not work together. I think in the right circumstances, well, we know in the right circumstances, Joe Dumars could be a good GM. Whether that's still the case, I don't know. It was definitely not the case under Gores. It was just not workable, and that led to the biggest trade problem was when they traded a first-rounder to get rid of Ben Gordon a year early to free money to sign Josh Smith, which is just sort of, you know, Dumars' last gasp attempt of doing something in Detroit, and it just worked out miserable. It sent the franchise back for years. But I don't want to blame Gores too much for that because he was a new owner, still learning the ropes. He's only gotten better. The big thing I really like, he's investing money in the arena that was privately built rather than asking for taxpayer funds. I might be in the minority of basketball fans who don't want their city to buy the team a new arena, but that's a big deal to me, and I've been very impressed with Gores for that.
All right, yeah, that's a good point there. Are you worried that they lost Arne Kander at all to the trainer to Minnesota, who a guy who had a great record back in those glory days in the mid-2000s when they went to, I think, 6 Eastern Conference Finals in a row? They perpetually had one of the healthiest teams in the league. Haven't been quite as good recently. What was the story with them losing him, and what do you think of it?
Well, it seemed pretty clear he lost a lot of influence when Stan Van Gundy came in. Van Gundy wanted his own guys. I think Arne Kander's fantastic. I think he did a fantastic job with this team. It does concern me that they trended in the wrong direction with injuries, and maybe that's just things evening out. But the overall sample is still impressive. Overall, during his tenure, the Pistons were healthier than average, and I think he deserves some credit for that. And I am worried they'll miss him. On the other hand, like I said, Gores has invested money. I don't think it's because they were being too cheap or anything like that. So I do think the chances that they have a good replacement are fairly high, but it's more of an unknown. I feel pretty confident that Kander would have done a good job.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, I think that's probably about all we've got. Anything to plug before you go?
You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Feldman NBA. You want something more than that? Is this your what should you read question?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is Or I mean, it can be not maybe something that you didn't write, but I figure I should give you like some ancillary benefit other than getting to just come on the podcast and sound smart, you can actually hopefully drive just my army of listeners to any of your writing because you sounded so smart.
Well, you said it doesn't have to be something I wrote, so I'm going to drive you, your listeners, to somebody else, non-basketball. I think there would be a cross-demographic here. End Zone by John U. Bacon, book came out this fall about the rise and fall of Michigan football. Fantastic, fantastic read. He's a great writer. If you're interested in how college sports work beyond Michigan, just using Michigan as a case study, just a fantastic read.
All right. Yeah, that's a good one. Actually, I'll give a recommendation, too. I just read a great article on SI.com about Jim Brown, a really long piece. He taught the guy, I think it was Tim Layden, talked to current running backs around, about him, talked to Jim Brown himself, talked to a bunch of his old teammates and competitors. Really good. Jim Brown, still the best running back of all time. Because I'm a football expert, I can say that. But in any event, that's a really good read, too. All right. Thanks so much to Dan for coming on. You can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Also, my Facebook page, facebook.com/NateDuncanNBA, is a good place to keep up with my writing. I wrote a piece on the Cauldron at Sports Illustrated this week about what teams might potentially challenge LeBron James and the Cavs. So check that out. The answer is probably nobody, but this is the way that it could maybe happen. Also, giving us a rating on iTunes is really appreciated, and also a comment is even better. And a great way to support the podcast as well is to use that cap space code on DraftKings or SeatGeek. That's how they know that you came from us, that their advertising is working, and they continue to then pay us, and that continues to keep us on the air. So that's awesome. Anyway, thanks a lot to Dan and for him and myself. We will talk to y'all next time.